I'm Jason Stein, publisher of Automotive News, and this is Daily Drive. It's Thursday, June 18th. As the saying goes, look up entrepreneur, and it's likely you'll find an image of a car dealer. The words inventive, creative, and daring could also apply, but perhaps nowhere more than at the Dream Motor Group, a 6-store retail operation based in Alabama, Texas, Louisiana, and Tennessee. And nowhere was the Dream Motor Group more creative than during a pandemic. Perhaps the conditions were perfect for the Dream Motor Group during this, its 15th anniversary. Perhaps the timing was right to pivot to a whole new business model, one that would reshape its immediate business and reaffirm its culture. And who knew that the Dream Motor Group would be one of the largest suppliers of PPE materials in the country? A move that started way back on April 4th and continues today. 65 million masks later, it was a daring move that allowed the group to keep every employee during COVID-19. More importantly, it created the chance for so many other wonderful things, including a highly creative pay plan for its employees. The architect is Joe Agresti, CEO of the group, and his executive vice president, Randy Powell. We've reached Joe in The Woodlands, Texas, and Randy in Birmingham, Alabama. Joe Agresti, how are you?
Great. How you doing, Jason? Thanks for having us.
For sure. And Randy Powell, good to talk to you.
Thank you, Jason. Glad to be here.
Joe, I want to start with you, and I want to start with the Dream Motor Group and the philosophy that you built, the culture that you built, which drove so many decisions during this pandemic. But let's start with January of 2005, 15 years ago. You were in a car, and you drove from New Jersey to Baton Rouge. Tell me the story of the beginning of the Dream Motor Group.
So I was actually employee number 0002 for the Asbury Automotive Group a long way back, and worked for them during the early stages right up until the IPO, and was young, 27. And the CEO, who's a wonderful guy, used to be the CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue, a guy named Brian Kendricks, who's since passed, kind of a hero of mine, to be honest. He, I'd asked him on multiple occasions, I'd done everything that needed to be done. I wanted to be the CEO. And he said, you're still a little boy. This isn't going to work out. I need to get you out in the field. So I went to Jackson, Mississippi, his hometown, where we had some, kind of issues. The dealer's fantastic, a guy named Bobby Gray, you may have heard of. And, but he hadn't dealt with having to contend with the administration of a large organization rolling up for an IPO. So they sent me to Jackson, Mississippi. I spent 3 years there. And during that time, ultimately I fell in love with the business, and, opportunities, came and went. And when Asbury was presented the opportunity to buy a store in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, they didn't have anything else there. So they didn't want it. So we bought it, me and Bobby Gray. And so I went up to New Jersey for, some period of time, let's call it non-compete. And I had a great relationship with Asbury. I still love those guys. And they called me up about 6 months in and said, this is silly. Go. And so I jumped in a car and I met my friends in Atlantic City, for New Year's Eve. And after, nursing a day and a half's worth of hangover, I began the journey to Louisiana. And drove through, and on January 5th, 2005, entered Baton Rouge. And from there, we, kind of all began. And not only my love of the business, but our growth into, kind of a Mercedes-Benz focused, for the most part, brand. We're connected to Mercedes-Benz indelibly in a lot of ways, a lot of relationships, a lot of experience, a lot of institutional knowledge. And so I'll leave it at that.
So you start with one Mercedes-Benz store, you add four more, and then you add an Infiniti store. And now all of a sudden we have the Dream Motor Group in 2020 going into its 15th anniversary. And how did January and February look for you, Joe?
Normal. Looked like the start of what we've historically done, which is improve upon our performance year in and year out just by getting smarter, approaching the market better, whether it be the manner in which we, market, manage our people, enforce and reinforce our culture, which we do in a lot of really interesting ways. If we have more time, I'd tell you about that, but it's kind of the backbone of all that we do. And so we went into January and February feeling we were good. Everything was fine.
And then what do you remember next?
So I have a hedge fund. And what happened was our hedge fund started to have in, you know, March, COVID becomes, well known, I'll call it. I don't know that everybody was terrified at this point, but it was the early stages of the eventual, horrific experience we've all had. And my hedge fund was out ahead of it because all the decisions that are, it's a quantitative hedge fund. So all the decisions that the algorithms make were pointing towards something that seemed, as it should be, the right decision. But since COVID was kind of the straw that was stirring the drink, everything made no sense. Because even though the basic economic principles that would tell you, go long oil and copper and, short the U.S. Treasury, it all made no sense because COVID, again, was the straw stirring the drink. So we got real smart, real fast, and put our, quantitative expert onto, looking at almost essentially COVID entirely, exclusively, should I say, not essentially. And so every Sunday we have calls with our partners in the hedge fund. And I quickly realized that the data that we were providing was really valuable to the point where, it made sense for a head of household or someone opening a business to get on these calls. So we started to invite more and more people. And at some point, we had the CEO of Mercedes-Benz North America. We had, Adam Chamberlain, VP of sales, and the highest level folks within Mercedes-Benz. But then all of a sudden, we have the CEO of Encore, CEO of 7-Eleven, CEO of the Howard Hughes Corporation, and people like Michael Cantanucci and other dealers that I have a ton of respect for. And we just realized that we had, 30 or 40 people dialing in for these Sunday phone calls just to get an understanding of what's going on. And one of them finally said to me, because we provided them an opportunity to give us, questions during the week that we would answer the next week. Someone said, how do you open your business up? How do you see this? And so we had since hired a medical director to make better decisions within the hedge fund. As I said, COVID was the straw stirring the drink. So the medical director and myself put together this 10-step process to open up. And one of those things was, of course, PPE, but, thermometers and, the protocol and when people should leave and how do we handle things. And I guess, without getting into the official particulars, because it's the interesting serial entrepreneurialism story that it really is amazing and interesting. If I jump past all that, I'd say what we decided was we need to do something fast because we were more educated than most people. And we had a great sense that there was a real concern for folks that had comorbidities, right? You're taking prednisone, you're, God forbid, on chemotherapy, potentially pregnant, bronchial related, heart related, other issues. We put together a pile of lists with the medical director, a list with a pile of things on it, age, of course. So we formed a list of folks that we knew were legitimately at risk. And we sent them home, paid them in full, said, go home. You don't need to work. Be careful. Stay out of society. We want to protect you. It was 7 to 9% of our team. They're home, paid in full. They just started coming back now, but we made them get doctor's notes because we want to make sure they're okay. And so we also did things with the folks that remained because they were not really genuinely at serious risk. Based on the data we had from our hedge fund, we were comfortable with the 35-year-old technician or whoever else it may be. And what we did that we think was really interesting, that was a function of what we agreed to do with our people when we designed this culture that was focused on our employees first. We basically said, we're going to give you 85% of what you used to make. And we can, instead of talking about the formula, just suffice it to say, we're going to give you 85% of what you would have otherwise made normally, if not for COVID, but you only have to work 4 days a week. So you're working 4 days, not five. And we need 85% of your pay. Or take your current pay plan, if it's incentive-based, like technicians based on how many hours they turn, or a service advisor, how many hours they sell, or a salesperson, how many vehicles they sell. Those folks that are on incentive-based pay plans, got their total pay calculated and multiplied by 130%. So we gave them not a choice they had to make. It was at the end of the month, we'll multiply by 130. And if that number is higher than 85%, we'll give you that. If 85% is higher, we'll give you the comfortability to know that you have that backdrop.
And how did
you? Amazingly, about half the people jumped up. Yeah. And hit the 130% number, even in the midst of this, you know, crazy situation.
And how did you arrive at those numbers?
A lot of modeling. We knew that if we put 110% out there, it might not be enough for people to jump in and realize that, you know, servicing the next, you know, hours worth of doing the next hours worth of work or selling the next car, it may not be worth it. I might resign myself to hiding in the back or being less active or not working as hard as I could. So it was a little bit of a qualitative exercise of saying, what would move people to still work? Give them a chance to possibly make more money during this period of time than they ever have before, yet be so, you know, be reasonable enough that we can afford to pay them in these times where we knew that regardless of what we did, our sales and service were going to be going backwards in the wrong direction.
And Randy, as the executive vice president of all of these stores, give us a sense of what the guidance was in the states where you were operating. How long were you closed? When did you reopen?
Well, each of our stores was able to stay open in some capacity. When Joe was talking about this goes back to the early phases of March, and the decision to send people home was kind of with the understanding that there was going to be some reduction in workforces required to maintain social distancing inside the store. So the 4-day work weeks had a two-part to them. One was to give these people some time to stay home and be with their family. And Jason, you can recall the tension in the air and the lack of understanding, and people were concerned and fearful. The other part was so that we could, you know, have less people. You know, 20% of our workforce would stay home. We had large capacity space to be able to spread people out so that we could maintain distancing. And by doing that and working with our local state city officials, we were able to keep each of our stores open through the entire time. Not at full capacity, but open.
So guidance in Louisiana as well as in Tennessee, Alabama.
Yeah, each of those states had slightly different stay-at-home or safer-at-home orders. The one that was the most impacted was our Baton Rouge store due to its proximity to New Orleans, which had turned out to be a hot spot.
Right.
So they had curfews, but each state allowed, the dealerships were deemed essential businesses in each state. There were certain functions we couldn't do. We had already had in place processes, which gets to my Mercedes, your Mercedes, your way, where we would deliver cars, we would do road tests at home. So when we took all of these processes that we had in place and refined them for this, it allowed us to stay open for sales and for service.
So Joe, I want to go back to you. The hedge fund identified some of the risks early on, but it sounds like, you know, perhaps working with the relative health departments in those states, you were able to come up with some safety guidelines, social distancing. You procured quality PPE before anybody had it. Sounds like you were also ahead of the game when it came to those measures.
Yeah, we were absolutely ahead of the game because of the hedge fund informing us. We were providing PPE for our dealer friends who couldn't get it because there was a wait until June, and this was March. And I had already procured, it ultimately, this is a side story in its own right, but this turned out to originally be a request from the folks at FedEx, which is our client, and Acadian Ambulance, where we build ambulances for on Sprinter chassis. They needed PPE to protect their people. It was just random calls from clients I have, know and love. And they basically said, hey, we need this product. So I'm doing the research for the head fund. I realize you need PPE. Now people, giant corporations are calling us. I reach out to people I'm on boards with, whether it be 7-Eleven or Amcor, folks, that know how to get things, and every call ended with, we need this. So, again, the story of how the serial entrepreneurialism that got us into the PPE game, which was essentially done primarily to satisfy those customers, but eventually transitioned into a means to make sure that we could pay our people in the manner I just described we were paying them. We didn't know about PPE, with the PPP support, whether that was going to be something that was available to us or not. It didn't matter. We knew we were going to pay our people. We knew we weren't going to fire anybody. As a matter of fact, when everybody else was firing people, You know, I told my team, if there's people out there that are knocking on our door, we don't want to go create problems. But if there's someone knocking on our door, let's hire them. We'll pay for them to stay home. But in the end, the PPE business became the tool we used to ensure that we could provide folks with the economics they needed, because so many husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends, whatnot, were losing their jobs. So our employees needed to be able to take care of themselves plus their significant other. So we committed to it. And so the PPE business went from something small to, I can't tell you exactly right now where we are, but I can tell you that we've sold over 65 million masks to the Atlanta Falcons, the state of Texas, the FAA, Department of Transportation, Department of Defense, you know, to Benzel Bush, my buddy Jay Agresta, Accuride, Sports Clips, Jersey Mike's, MCOR, the Pentagon Federal Credit Union. I mean, these are just out of memory. There's a ton. So it turned into a business that was, again, supposed to make sure that we could pay our people, and it did that. It did that.
And how did all of those groups find out that you had access to that?
You know, just call everyone you know. You put together a good brochure, call everyone you know. If you have a good reputation, you know, everybody makes mistakes in life. I've certainly made mine, but when it comes to business ethics, I'm unimpeachable. And so when I talk to the folks that I know, they were happy to put their name next to mine, and one person talked to the next. I mean, of course, you know, Nick Saban's a partner in the Dream Motor Group. So Nick Saban made a commercial, and the commercial was less about the product because he didn't want to attach himself to a particular product. But he made a commercial about me. And the commercial was, this guy works as hard as anyone I know. You can trust him. He'll do the right thing. And, you know, not only was it an immense sense of pride in hearing him actually say those words, but obviously when we sent them out to people, they were like, okay, we can trust this guy. As opposed to the flyby nights that were popping up that had opened the business 3 days before. And, you know, I'll sell them to you, but they ultimately didn't have any product. So we spent a ton of money, bought product, had it in warehouses that were actually given to us like in a philanthropic nature, like the MCOR CEO, Tony Guzzi, wonderful guy, 37,000 employees. He gave us a warehouse and took care of shipping. And so we had stuff flying in, being dropped into his warehouse. They were arranging it and shipping it out for us as we sold it to people. And it became a money-making enterprise. But the entire purpose of it, which is the essence of the story, since we're talking about the automotive space, is we were going to do whatever we had to do to make sure that no one got fired and they got paid probably more than they ever did, which turned out to be the case at least 50% of people, because we wanted to make sure that they were able to contend with their own potential issues plus their significant others. So many of which lost their jobs, as we know. So it was a noble effort that turned into be a bit of a monster work-wise. I'd say I've been working 16 hours a day, 7 days a week from home, spending a good three quarters of that on the PPE business, while Randy handles, you know, the stuff that I would otherwise do a good portion of myself.
So what is it
for Randy?
Indeed. What is it about the PPE business that you can apply to the car business?
Well, I mean, again, I'd say it's serial entrepreneurialism. The story of how we got there is insane. I mean, I had a call with a guy who connected me with a famous restaurateur, and the guy said, he's the CEO of a big company, said, Joe, I always call you a retail savant. Talk to our guy. We have a bunch of restaurants with him, 30 or 40 restaurants around the world. I'm not going to name his name, but he's somebody everybody knows, one of the finest restaurateurs in the world. And the conversation basically went to, it started with, we're being told by folks in the government that we have to space double, and that's going to kill us. What do you see? And I said, well, you know, you got to shorten your customer list. I mean, shorten your menu, so that people make decisions quicker and you have less spoilage. You got to turn your tables twice as fast or double the fee, or turn your tables 1.5 times and increase your price by 150% plus. And the conversation went on and on. And it turned into a broader context conversation about how the food distribution business is actually doing fairly well, because although they're distributing 80% less to restaurants, they're distributing 60% more to individual customers, because people, you know, through grocery stores and other stores, because people are still eating. And I thought to myself, and I thought to myself, and I the second this came out in March, and I knew where we were, I went out and got the second freezer and the second refrigerator and filled it full of steaks and frozen shrimp and scallops. Like I gained 12 pounds during this exercise. So many people did, right? And probably had 100 beers too many, right?
Right.
So that being said, you know, I realized that the circumstances weren't such that the entire, you know, U.S. Population wasn't eating anymore. So I asked a very natural question. What's happening with lobsters? It sounds like a ridiculous question, but it wasn't. And the reason I asked it was because of all the things you could freeze, lobsters aren't one of them. And so I asked how that works. And he said, if you go into a Ruth Chris and you see a bunch of lobsters in a tank, there's also a huge distribution tank at the distribution centers for live lobsters. That's 1,000 times bigger than that. And they're full. And so I said, you know, so effectively in my mind, I'm picturing all the tankers floating around. A couple of weeks ago, oil prices were negative. And there's a bunch of tankers floating around the Gulf of Mexico. And because it was cheaper than storing them on land. So I get off the phone, have this conversation, get off the phone. I call up my buddy. I'm like, hey, talk, you know, he's in Maine. Do you know anybody in the lobster business? He goes, yeah. I go, can you set me up on a call? He says, sure, I'll do it right now. They connect me in. I get this phone conversation. I said, what's going on in the lobster business? He said, it's horrible. The folks in China know that we've got nowhere to sell it here in the U.S., and so they're asking us for half price because they're taking advantage of the situation, coupled with the fact that pricing went from $800,000 for a 747-400F to double that, actually $1.8 million, $1.9 million. And I said, what if I pay for your shipping? I said, why would you do that? I said, because you're going to bring PPE back, and I'm going to send your lobsters over on my dime. And that's how it started. Like I said, serial entrepreneurialism.
No kidding.
And it turned into a business that, you know, now it's very different. We have sourcing agreements with really reputable companies. We're lobbying to make sure that, you know, they're all on the appropriate approved list. And, you know, Coach Saban's making commercials. And it's been really an amazing, you know, ride. But refocusing back onto the car business was just a function of, you know, everyone said, you know, 1990 with the internet boom, Greenlight.com and Cars.com and everybody else, no one's ever going to buy a car at a dealership again. But somehow we car dealers found a way to survive. And, you know, we shucked and jived and found a way to be, you know, provide a more compelling experience for customers. You know, your Mercedes Your Way was just all we normally do, but put a name on it. We at one point in time, and I'm transitioning back and forth chronology wise, but we basically, you know, at one point in time had a customer, a husband and wife sitting on their porch. The first car drove up, brought them a bottle of wine, two glasses. They drank a bottle of wine, or I don't know how much they drank. They drank some wine. And we had five salespeople drive around their parking, drive around their house, a little, you know, pergola in their home, and showed them the five different cars they were interested in. It was an amazing experience, but it's kind of the nature of what we do, right? So back to 1990, all of a sudden, everyone's going to buy on the internet. It never happened. They still needed us to tell them why the car makes sense. Touch it, feel it, smell it, drive it. They needed to do that. And we just found a more convenient and comfortable way to do that with a focus on hospitality versus, you know, classic customer service, right? What can we do to make your experience better? What can we do to make your life better? What can we make you feel better about us than you felt about any other dealership before? And that's like, you know, the fundamental culture, nature of our culture.
Randy, let me ask you finally, when you look at the car business now, where we are today, how are your stores looking?
Jason, they're much better than we anticipated. We had, you know, modeled this as much as we possibly could. We kind of knew that sales would take a hit. We thought service would hold its own. And, you know, drop. And what we found was cars did take an immediate hit. Service took a sliding hit, but service kept going. And the sales side of the business, came back much quicker than we expected, strongly biased towards pre-owned cars. Some of that due to supply and demand as the manufacturers just shut down their plants and distribution centers and were only shipping very limited numbers. But as we rolled out of April and into May, we saw our numbers come back. In several of our stores, the pre-owned business is the best it's ever been. Profitability is a bit of a challenge, and you know there are some of our costs have gone up, but for the most part, we're delighted with how it's moving.
Oh, that's great.
I would jump in on that and please. Say I agree fully, but wanted to add one comment, which sure. is, you know, in concert with our culture, which is not just, you know, Dream Motor Group, the concept is to make, you know, dreams come true for our employees, our customers, and our community. And that's the, you know, the essence. Call it what you want, our mantra. And in it, we commit to doing all three of those things. And when we had a bunch of employees that we were paying anyway, and they were at work, we'd rather they not sit around because, you know, an idle mind is a devil's workshop. Instead, we provided free service for our community for people who lost their jobs or were furloughed. And so we gave up to $500 of free service at our stores because our technicians were there anyway. They would prefer working. It's in their hearts to be. That's how we hire. We hire in a way to make sure that we have people that are like-hearted as well as like-minded. So those folks couldn't wait to help. They were sitting there. We were paying them. So we brought people in and we fixed their cars for free. And it felt right, felt good. Everybody's proud of it. And in the grand scheme of things, between giving people, you know, firing nobody, giving them a sense of security in their compensation, as I described before with the 85-130, and then reaching out to the community in the way we did. We also gave tons of PPE away to hospitals and fire departments and police departments, et cetera. In all that, in summary, I probably got, Randy, I don't know how many you have, but I got probably 40 or 50 letters, text messages, emails, handwritten letters, text messages or emails to say, this is everything you told us we were. And we're really proud of the way you guys handled it. And in the end, if there's anything that's important for me to relay on this, it's we went back to the cultural roots that we used to design the organization in the first place. We didn't forget them, although there were moments that were difficult, especially when, you know, Randy said we're going to have to pay 130% out to do the right thing. It was a little bit difficult to absorb, knowing we're going to lose money. But we ultimately let the culture decide what to do, and we followed it. And the decisions became easier. We ask our employees all the time that wear these culture cards, these lanyards on their chest. Anytime you have a problem with an employee or a decision to make or a customer, read the fundamental principles that are on the back of the card, and they answer almost every question. But we had to do that ourselves, and we did. And we feel really proud of the manner in which we handled this by and large. And Randy, you know, I know I'm not interviewing you, but would you agree that we walked away from this with a like reinforced sense that what we've done culturally is exactly the right thing and you're proud of how you handled it? Cause I know that I am.
Joe, I'm very proud of how we handled it. And like you said, our employees speak louder than us. I probably have at least as many as you said, unique, different messages from our employees. I have messages from families of employees. I've got customers who've come up to me and says, I just left the doctor's office and you guys are more gowned up and I feel cleaner and safer here than I did before. Joe, we gave away hundreds of thousands of masks across the cities that we're in to the first responders and other hospitals and people who need them. I'm just delighted. This is one of those highlights. You know, you thought this was going to be one of the worst of times, and it turned out to be one of those times I'm going to look back and say, this was a good experience.
Well, that's a wonderfully positive note to leave it on. Gentlemen, I thank you both for being on Daily Drive. Thanks for sharing your very unique story, and happy 15th anniversary.
Thank you. Jason. Appreciate you. Thanks, Jason. Drive safe. Take care.
We reached Joe Agresti in The Woodlands, Texas, and Randy Powell in Birmingham, Alabama. And that's Daily Drive for Thursday, June 18th. For breaking news, go to autonews.com. And for a library of these stories, go to autonews.com/dailydrive. We'll be back Friday.